Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. I'm sure you've heard that many times yourself, and probably at least once this summer. We're going to talk with our weather guys about heat and humidity and a whole lot more with them. And thank you for spending some of your day with us here on the Ideas Network. Our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, one of them, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to see your smiling face.
It's good to see you too, Larry. And I hate high dew points, personally.
I bet John Martin does too. If John's here, he's a professor, former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. Good to see you.
So as we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in. What summer weather questions do you have? Have you observed a weather event you'd like to talk about? What are your severe weather questions, maybe? The number to call to join in is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, let's talk about humidity. It feels like it's been humid lately. Are summers getting more humid, do you think?
I don't know if there's any verdict in on that. I doubt it. I have a feeling that they're, you know, they, around here anyway, the high humidity that we're experiencing right now is episodic. We get it a couple of times, maybe three times a year. I don't think there's been any increase in the average summertime dew point. And maybe even if you grouped only the highest dew point days at stations like Madison, you might not yet see any increase in the top 15 highest dew points of the summer. But, you know, I think we've had a beneficent summer and late spring. We haven't really had too much exceptional heat. This, we only had 7 days at 90 or above. The average is about 13, and we're at the end of July. So we've had a pretty decent summer that way. But when it gets like this, people notice. And this, you know, it's, of course, that's going to mean, is this, it's going to bring up questions of, is it getting worse? I'm not sure it is, but it's a good question, easily pursued. I haven't done it.
What?
And while it's been a great summer temperature-wise, but we haven't had enough precipitation, particularly in southern Wisconsin. Oh, a lot
that's
of
right.
Wisconsin, yeah.
Nine
that's the downside.
For the year.
Yeah.
So then why do we get it? Is it the rain that brings it? Or why do we get humidity? High humidity.
Well, there's latitudinal differences in humidity. You know, you're up north like we are. We tend to be preserved from the long periods of humidity. You don't have to go as far south as even St. Louis before you get day after day after day dew points in the high 60s all summer long. By the time you get down to the Gulf Coast, you're lucky if you have a few days all summer that have a dew point less than 60, and probably not more than 10 or so that have dew points, you know, really really low in the upper 60s. So it's there's a strong latitudinal gradient in the water vapor content of the air on average. And when the flow comes from the southwest in the summertime, yeah, for us, that's all it takes. We get an import, yeah, of really high water vapor content, yeah.
And so why is the west then? I mean, they get dry heat as we get the humidity. Then what is it that's creating it for the west or not creating it for the west?
Yeah, the west is at higher elevation. That's one thing. And then also they're not, you know, exposed to the Gulf of Mexico quite the way we are. We can have water vapor that originates in evaporative events over the Gulf of Mexico, that water stays in the air all the way up to, you know, Lake of the Woods, because there isn't much orography to wring it out. But over the western states, there's so much mountainous terrain that it's hard for very high water vapor content air from the Baja California, for instance, to make it all the way to Denver. It will never get there. It'll get wrung out on some mountain thunderstorm.
Yeah, that makes sense. Steve, you were going to add something there, I think.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to add is that around us and to our south, there's a lot of corn, and corn is really good at transpiring, so it pulls moisture that's in the soil out and pulls it into the atmosphere as well. And so there have been studies of air as it moves from the southern region, like in the Louisiana area, believe it or not, which is already really humid, as it moves northward, it actually picks up moisture as it goes over the cornfields. So we have that, and the West also doesn't have that, but the West has mountains. So
So the humidity in Iowa, would it be worse than, say, it is in Wisconsin? They've got more corn than we've got.
Yeah, the dew point at Waterloo, Iowa, is several times a summer. I don't know what it is right now. I could look at a map quickly. Maybe I'll do that when we're on break. But several times per summer, the dew point exceeds 80 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just exceptional. I mean, that almost never happens. And so anywhere else. And so they're probably one of the most humid Midwest locations is the state of Iowa. Iowa is effectively an inland sea, as Steve points out, when the corn is growing, because that John Norman, who's a colleague of ours many years, said it's effectively a 6-inch deep inland sea at the time of maximum growth for the corn because it transpires and manages its water so poorly. That's amazing. That's a big ocean.
Yet another reason to stay in Wisconsin.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, man. Steve from Mineral Point called with two questions on dew point. One, why does the low temperature rarely get below the dew point temperature? And then, how can you have a dew point below freezing?
So, yeah, I mean, the dew point is often a good measure of the nighttime minimum, what the end of the day dew point is, because at nighttime, the atmosphere cools off. We have no solar energy, so the temperature drops. And when the temperature drops and hits the dew point, then dew begins to form. And when you take water vapor in the gaseous form and condense it into a liquid, that releases energy into the atmosphere. So it really slows down how much the atmosphere can cool because it adds energy to the atmosphere by condensation. And when you can, if you have the dew point below freezing, that just means when the temperature hits that dew point or frost point, then frost forms instead of dew point, instead of liquid water.
That makes sense to me. John, you're a Boston Red Sox fan.
Yes, probably, I am.
And yes, they're beating the Yankees. Thank you.
They're in pretty good shape right now in terms of standing.
Go Brewers!
Yes, go Brewers for me and for Steve. But
oh, me too.
I've heard. Yeah, you're a Brewers fan too. But your heart is in Boston with the Red Sox. I kind of think. Yeah, I've heard baseball broadcasters refer to heavy air on humid days. Can the air actually affect how a baseball travels?
No question about it. We just saw in the Home Run Derby a couple of weeks ago, the new record now, I think it was Juan Soto, hit a ball 524 feet. They measure these things precisely during this exhibition, and that broke the record that a Colorado Rocky player himself had held for quite a long time. The reason why, because they were played at Coors Field. They're at 850 millibars, where the air is about 15% less dense than it is at sea level in Boston or in Chicago or someplace else. And so it affects the length of travel of the ball because the air is less dense. And so they had to move the fences back at Coors Field and at the Brewers AAA, I think at Colorado Springs for a while, they had a AAA affiliate. They had to move the fences back at high altitude to make it fair. And it's a real bummer for these guys who are hitting lots of home runs when they're at, elevation. And then they start playing in Yankee Stadium or someplace else. They realize they can't hit the ball quite as far. So that's not any fun. We were at the game yesterday, my son and I, and it was one of the most humid days of the summer. And so, I could just sense that the broadcasters and fans were – there's a lot of White Sox fans too, so there's a level of ignorance there that you have to incorporate into the discussion on this point. I'm kidding, White Sox fans. You were great yesterday. We had a good time. But they'll say, oh, it's heavy air because it's so humid. The air is less dense when it's humid because water vapor is less dense than dry air. It's a simple fact. So you got to find another excuse.
So straighten this up for me. So if you've got a humid day, is it going to make a difference? in how the ball travels.
It would make it, if all things were equal, it would be easier to hit a home run on a humid day.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it saps your energy. It has a physiological impact on your playing ability that is not related to what the condition of the air is when the ball's in flight. So they're working at cross purposes. But without question, on a humid day, you should have an easier time hitting a ball farther. But of course you don't, because you're exhausted.
So John, knowing how careful baseball is about its statistics, this home run derby that they had in Denver, they can't count that as records, can they? Without a star next to them.
No, I know. I think that's right. But that's not up to me. If it were up to me, I'd say never play at Coors Field if you want to set these kind of, funny records, that they're not fair. But yeah. Everyone knows Mickey Mantle hit the ball farther than anybody, and he hit it in Pittsburgh or someplace like that. So Mantle or Ted Williams, they still hold the record. They didn't need to be at elevation to hit it 580 feet. Reggie Jackson, too.
Yeah.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman.
Don't be a pitcher for a Denver team, right?
No, their team ERA is routinely the highest in the major leagues. And it's not an accident. It's not an accident.
John Martin, Steve Ackerman, our guests. Well, Maria in Reedsburg, let's go to you. Maria, thanks for calling.
Well, it says Reedsburg, but actually I'm calling about a Baraboo event because we own a home there. And about a week and a half ago, there was a severe weather event that took out numerous trees in a small area, but the devastation was pretty big and crushed one house and knocked it off its foundation, put holes in the rental house that we own. And what I'm calling to ask is, if I recall correctly, it was deemed a microburst. I don't know if either of your guests or you, Larry, are familiar with that storm that happened in Baraboo. And if it was a microburst, could you explain a little bit more about what a microburst is and how it works?
All right. Maria, that's a good question. Thank you so much. Well, let's see. Steve, do you want to take a crack?
Sure. I think I saw something on a Facebook post about that Baraboo storm, but I didn't read anything from the National Weather Service or not. But yeah, what a microburst is, it's a small-scale event, weather event. That's why they call it micro. And what it's associated with is thunderstorms. And so when a thunderstorm or a convective storm, I should say, is developing, when it starts to precipitate, it brings down air from up above with it. And as that air comes pulling down, it can drag some high velocity air that's occurring up in the atmosphere down to the surface. And then when it hits the ground, it kind of spreads out. And it's that spreading out that really can have very strong winds associated with that burst as it hits the ground, and that does a lot of what the damage is associated with the microburst. But they're generally small areas associated with smaller storms, and that's why it could hit Baraboo and not other cities in the area.
So, say a city this a microburst could include something at least as large as Baraboo, Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure that's the right way to think of it in terms of hitting Baraboo as being localized to people who live in the Baraboo area.
Yeah.
There's probably a better way to think of it.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay. That makes sense to me. Maria, does that help?
I'd like to make one other comment about that. It only hit a very small portion of Baraboo. It was like about 3 to 4 blocks wide and about 6 or 7 blocks long. And
wow.
So people in other parts of town were like, what? No, had no clue.
Yeah, so it's a small, physically sized weather event, and it also doesn't last that long. And so that's why it would hit just a small area. It wouldn't propagate across the state.
And so what, I mean, why doesn't that happen with any thunderstorm? What are the, what's the key thing going on there that causes it maybe to happen?
Probably so one of the things.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Steve. Sorry.
Yeah, I'll say one thing, and then maybe John can add about the thermodynamic structure in the atmosphere. But as a storm begins to precipitate, the cloud is saturated. Relative humidity is 100%. Once those particles get big enough and fall out the base of the cloud and are trying to become precipitation by heating the ground, they begin to evaporate. And that evaporation causes a cooling of the air around it. And cooler air is heavier, and so that helps to accelerate the downward momentum of the air that's kind of carrying the precipitation, or that's coming along with the precipitation.
And John, to add to that?
Yeah, that was all I was going to say, and highlight the fact that it's a local interaction of the environment with the storm that might have so many different, you know, possible combinations that not every place gets the downburst. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Very cool. John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve Ackerman, also a professor there, but he is, his main job right now is vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. That keeps him busy and probably a sleepless night or two along the way here, especially during these COVID times. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or go ahead and email us the email address. And by the way, if you've got a cool weather photo, we'd love to see those too. Email that photo or your question to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Or call us, 800-642-1234. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then our weather guys will be back right after that. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking climate and weather with our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve's also Vice Chancellor for Research, and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. So as we visit with them, I hope you'll join in with your weather questions or climate questions. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or pick up the phone and call 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. And if you got a weather photo, we'd love to see that as well. Well, Kenneth from Janesville was wondering, can weather experts forecast humidity? And if so, where's the best place to find that information? He was also wondering what's the relationship between humidity and dew.
Yeah, that's routinely available. The National Weather Service written forecast will almost always mention overnight low temperature, and that's a good indication of what the dew point is. It's not a perfect one, as we talked about a few minutes ago. But they'll you can look on many of the phone applications will say something about the humidity as well by probably by proxy, again, by high and low temperature. So that's kind of how I use it when I have to quickly respond to a friend's inquiry that what's 5 days going to be like? Is it going to be as muggy? And I look at the five-day forecasted overnight low. And if it's in the 60s, it's going to be muggy. If it's in the 50s, it's not. So you can get that forecast, but it's probably a little bit less high profile than the forecast for precipitation or high temperature. But it is there. It's in the written forecast.
So if you just go to the National Weather Service site,
yeah,
then?
I type into my browser, I put NWS for National Weather Service, and then NKE, being in the southern part of the state, from Milwaukee. If you do Green Bay, GRB, or any other part of the country, you'll be able to find the Weather Service forecast when you navigate their website, which admittedly is a little bit intimidating at first, but not so hard to figure out.
Jeff in Kenosha, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I live in Kenosha, but I noticed the National Weather Service and all the local television channels from Milwaukee use the temperature from the airport, which is like 5 miles inland. Yet the vast majority of us live within a mile of the lake. Like right now at my house, it's 84, yet the airport says it's 91. So you can't get an accurate temperature because nobody really lives out at the airport. Is there any way they could move it into town, or who makes those decisions?
I think there's a couple of things why they wouldn't move it in. One is if you move it into town, then you get the urban effect. It's going to, in particularly during the summertime, or even the wintertime, it's going to bias the temperatures higher than the areas around the urban site. The temperature, and that's the key, the temperature is very localized, and it varies on how close you are to a big water body, the type of vegetation, or the surface type that the station is over as well. And so in order to keep really good climate, long-term climate records, there are particular types of surfaces that they want these sites located. They don't want to locate them on banks or ground. It's over fields in general, and it has to be open. So you're not blocked by trees or anything in order to get an accurate measurement of the precipitation. And so the best place to put that is out in airports, and that allows you to give good observations that are not affected by the environment where the observations are being made, and therefore give you a long-term climate record. But as you point out, Jeff, the key is to know what is your relationship to that area. And we see the same thing in Madison. The
sure
official
do.
Measurement is made out at the airport. But if you live downtown, it's going to be warmer. And if you live on the coast of one of our lakes, it's going to be cooler. And so you always have to have that in mind when you hear those official temperatures being made.
Yeah, and it's a good point, Steve. And in Madison, we have the so-called pit effect. Dane County Regional Airport is in a little bit of a valley. It's hard to discern by eye, but it's notable, apparently, especially when it gets really cold. Almost nobody in the city itself or in the outlying communities has as low a temperature as the airport on really cold mornings, and that's routinely the case.
Yeah.
So, sometimes you get a call from a family member who's far away and says, wow, it was minus 18 this morning in Madison. No, it was plus 3 at my house, but it was minus 18 at the airport.
Right.
Not usually and that big a difference, but it's different enough.
And it's key, as John is pointing out, the other way, if you want to have an accurate observations and you have an open sky type situation, if you want accurate precipitation, is to get a weather station and put it in your home someplace.
There are the stations that we're talking about in detail in this response are so-called first-order stations for the Weather Service, but there are lots of second-order stations. And occasionally on the webpage at any of the Weather Service sites, if you search far enough, you can actually find a listing of regional temperatures in the last hour, and you'll notice exactly what you're talking about. Somebody might have an observation at Wind Point in Kenosha, for instance, that's nothing like the city itself and so on, and you start to see these differences. And they register true compared to your own experience.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Jeff. Thank you very much. Kevin in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I always look forward to these monthly visits with the weather guys. Last Friday night, watching the moon, there were cloud banks interspersing with it. And I saw distinctly like a funnel cloud coming from the upper one to the lower one. Is that possible?
Wow. Was it active in the sense that you could see it spinning, or did it look like just a connecting tendril of cloud? It's hard to know.
It looked like it was connected cloud to cloud. I could not actually see it spinning, but it was wavering,
That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I don't remember Friday night. At least around here, it was nothing particularly convective about Friday night. So maybe there was a local condition that is not kind of jiving with what I recall myself here in Madison on Friday. But my broad answer is anything's possible in the atmosphere. I honestly mean that. I mean, you can just about see anything, and that's what makes it so fun. But I don't know if I have an explanation for it.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to disagree with John just a little bit.
Good. No, that's good.
Only in the sense that it's probably not a funnel type cloud. It might look like a funnel. But, if you're seeing two different cloud layers, It's probably not having that kind of strong dynamic to generate what we would classically call a funnel. And so between those two cloud layers, Kevin, was there clear sky or was it also cloud in there?
It was a full moon, I think, but the moon was right behind this funnel cloud.
So the only thing I'm thinking of, and I doubt that this is an explanation, is that sometimes if the high clouds begin to have what we call fall streaks, so the ice crystal particles in there get big enough, they fall out of the cloud. And sometimes, as they fall out, they're going to evaporate or sublime. And sometimes that process makes a thing that looks like a funnel in that it's big at the cloud base and then gets smaller. And sometimes they'll seed the cloud below it and cause that cloud to then also precipitate or have particles fall out of it.
Yeah, you know, as you say that, Steve, if such a thing, and they do happen, you can see them during the day quite easily. If such a process was illuminated by moonlight, it would really look otherworldly and it would catch your attention. Even though it's rather common on other days in the middle of the day.
That makes sense. Kevin, thank you so much. George in Glendale, your turn. Hi, George.
Hi. I've got two questions. And my first question is why are some areas having drought and low water levels, such as the upper Mississippi, blamed on climate change? And why are some areas having floods, such as in Europe and other places, on climate change? That's question one. My second question is, what impact, if any, will desalinization of the oceans, which are apparently rising due to climate change, and having the pure water go to, say, cities or areas of drought, have on the impact of the rising of the oceans if we take some of the take much of the water out and desalinate it?
Okay, a couple of interesting questions there. Who wants to take
I'll
start?
I'll try the first one. The first one about,
and I'll try the second one after John.
How you can get variations in impacts from what may or may not be really being controlled by the background climate change. Let me make my point as clear as I can. There is undeniably a background climate change that is ongoing, and it's measurable in lots of different ways. There's no question about that. There's no room really anymore for reasonable skepticism about that fact. There may, however, still be plenty of room for reasonable skepticism about whether or not that background change is influencing and, in fact, directing individual weather events that look extreme. I think I am a little bit skeptical that of my community that we think we've gotten to the state of maturity in this so-called attribution science, where we can say 16% of this event was not going to happen if it weren't occurring in the current climate. I am a little skeptical about that. So, you know, when it's the floods in London are interesting, but they're not unprecedented. The drought here in the West is devastating, but again, not unprecedented. So these things are all probably becoming, I think, a little bit more probable in an altered climate. But the individual instance of one or another of those events is not directly attributable to the background climate change. And in other words, if that were not occurring, it wouldn't have flooded this week in London. For somebody to make that kind of a statement categorically, that's an imprudent scientific statement at this stage of our knowledge. So I hope that explains the you know, some of the variables that are at play here.
Yeah, and in the desalination question, I guess two things came to my mind, two approaches to addressing that question. The first was that as our, you know, when we get in a warming climate and we're seeing this happen, the ice sheets are breaking down, glaciers are also melting, the ice on Greenland and Antarctica are melting and going into the to our oceans, the Arctic Ocean and the Southern Oceans. And while that's a heck of a lot of water, fresh water, that's going into the oceans, the amount of salt water in the oceans is huge. Yeah. And so it's not going to have a much effect or probably a measurable effect on the amount of salt in the oceans in terms of that way. So when the sea levels rise, it's still going to be the salt water. The other question I was thinking of, it was desalination in itself. So, you know, as the glaciers melt and they no longer become a source of water for areas that rely on that mountain water during the springtime to provide fresh water, we may have to go to a type of activity of desalination. Hmm. So you take the salt out of the water so that it becomes drinkable. The only thing I'll add to that is that I spent a couple of weeks in Saudi Arabia many years ago in a field program, and they were desalinating water. It tasted terrible. That much I'll say. It's just hard to get all that salt out. Now, I'm sure they've gotten better in 25 years, but I would rather we find a way to conserve our fresh water that's on land so that we continue drinking that and don't have to go to desalination.
And it's not cheap, is it? I thought it was really prohibitively expensive for a long time. Maybe it still is.
But it was in Saudi Arabia in the 80s. So, they had a lot of money back then.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, they didn't care much about what.
Yeah, right. They were talking about stopping dune movements. So the dunes in the deserts move. The wind moves them around. Mm. And they're big, just like snowdrifts. And so if a dune goes on a roadway, it blocks the roadway. And you cannot just drive around it because these dunes are huge.
Yeah.
And so one way they were looking at stopping the movement was to spray oil on them.
Oh, my God.
That's how much oil they had.
Wow.
Right? Just spray it on there. And that would have stopped their movement. Well, it would have stopped that one they sprayed, not the one behind
it. Yeah, right.
I keep thinking about John in the wintertime driving through snowdrifts. You're not going to do that with a sand dune.
You're not doing that with a sand dune.
No, my favorite road here in town is the one that goes right by Tenney Park on a windy, snowy day because the snow just keeps on coming. It's like a big train.
Oh, man. Well, Pete from Maquantigo emailed to say he's been fascinated with lightning ever since a few years back. He was standing on the porch. His porch, and a bolt of lightning came down and struck the lawn 15 feet away from him. He's wondering if there's less lightning occurring. He's only seen one good storm in his area this year. And judging from lightning fatality statistics for the U.S. the past couple of years, doesn't appear to have to be a local phenomena. Deaths are way down. Have you been able to look at data from form any theories on lightning?
That's a really good question. First off, if lightning hit, in the lawn in front of me where I was standing, I would not want more lightning.
No.
I would also go and look for the, what's that mineral then, the rock that it forms, fulgurite?
Oh, yeah, fulgurite, yeah.
Yeah, so that happens in the soil, so I would go dig that up. But yeah. A couple of years ago, we put up a new sensor on a satellite to detect lightning. And I think even though that's a short-term record, I think I don't know what the answer is. But if anybody's gone and analyzed that, that would be the best way to do it. Because you really need, the thing about lightning is, it's like tornadoes and some other weather, like microbursts. They're very localized. And so to get a good observation of it, you really need a good broad network being able to measure them.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, that there's been a real big increase in the ways by which that could be measured. The other thing about the fact that there haven't been too many storms this year is just we're 9 inches below precipitation for the year, about 6 inches below since April 1. So we've been in a period where we just haven't had our normal complement of thunderstorms. That's just a simple fact. It's not, I don't have an explanation for it. I'm just saying that that's the case. And as a consequence, at any given location, you're likely to notice, if you pay attention to it, that you're not having as much lightning, definitely this year.
I don't know if you guys saw it. Somebody sent me a video of there were some people at a driving range, golf driving range, hitting balls. It was a covered, they were hitting from a covered area to an uncovered area. And they're videoing the one guy hitting a ball, and he hits the ball, and it goes out, and a lightning bolt hits the ball.
Yeah. Wow. I saw that video. I watched it like eight times. It was so amazing.
That's nice.
Yeah.
drive for show, right? The old thing, putt for to drive for show. That's the biggest show I've ever heard of on a drive, right there.
It is. I don't know. Just plug in a golf ball getting hit by lightning or something into your search engine, and you're probably going to find the video of it. It is absolutely amazing and scary.
Now, to go back to Pete's other message that he was saying, how there are less deaths by lightning. Yeah. Part of that could be a knowledge of what to do. So let's be clear right now. In a lightning storm, don't go out and start hitting golf balls hoping to get that kind of video. Because even if you're under cover, there are still metal poles there holding up their cover. And there's nothing to stop that lightning from coming inside where you're standing, holding a metal club. So
that's right.
They were lucky. It worked out. It's great video. But please don't go and try that. Yeah, it's dangerous. No,
that's good advice.
Oh, man. Dawn from Madison wonders, she feels she's noticed weather forecasts seem to get more sensationalized nationally. Lots of TV networks spend time concentrating on the Northeast Wisconsin and Northeast U.S. and not a lot on the Midwest, where many of the storm systems seem to hit first. Locally, it seems like lots of meteorology predictions like heavy rain produced, but then nothing happens.
I think Dawn's been talking to my dad in Massachusetts. Okay, I'm going to say that. I love my father. There's nobody who's had more of an influence on me than him. And yet it's exactly the same complaint in reverse. Why don't they ever talk about New England? They're always talking about the Midwest. So I don't really know what to think about this. It's like they talk to each other and just got their stories reversed. And this,
but
and
they
the
do seem.
We're supposed to get a flood. Nothing happened.
But if you watch like the CBS Evening News or something, Al Roker will come on and he usually brings a bit of more energy maybe than you might expect he should have done.
All joking aside, I think there has been a trend to sensationalize the news. And is Fox News Network's going to have a weather channel now? And what are they going to talk about? Who knows? Chemtrails or something. But you know, it's gonna be increasingly sensationalized because everybody's trying to make some money, and weather interests lots of people. And so I suppose there's that commercial, lever that people are pulling. I don't disagree with Don. It is, and it gets in the way of our job of trying to communicate what we think we know about the atmosphere in a scientific way. The sensationalism gets in the way of that.
And I'll just add, but let's not confuse sensationalizing something with the need to communicate. And thinking of is, during one of the NBA finals game, right, there was a tornado that moved into the Milwaukee area and some of the local channels cut in to talk about it. And that was really important, although I'm sure there were a number of people, myself included, saying, get back to the game. I can watch this on radar.
Right? Yeah, right.
But they kept apologizing for it all the while they were doing it.
And that was a good thing. But it was important to let people know where this thing is because, John and I can go on our, get our iPhones and look at where radar is doing and interpret that. But if you're not an expert in doing that, it's really dangerous when there's a tornado in an area trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
Before you know it, you'll be out on the golf course hitting balls with a with a metal club. That's the best thing to do.
On that note, thanks, guys, so much. We'll look forward to your next visit the last Monday of next month. Thanks, John, Steve.
Okay. Yeah,
appreciate it. John Martin, Steve Ackerman from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve also is Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. Great to have them with us. Tomorrow we have a Wisconsin dog trainer join us to talk about improving your dog's behavior. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.